Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be Dennis Pate, Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo and Aquarium. The title of his presentation will be, What's New at the Zoo? He'll talk about the zoo's master plan progress, including the former Rosenblatt Stadium site, future growth in exhibits, and significant animal acquisitions and births. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 28, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Joni Ballion, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Last year, 2012, the renovated Scott Aquarium opened to rave reviews and thousands of visitors. We also discovered the prehistoric play park and fossil dig site and welcomed babies like frill dragons, an aardvark, five African lion cubs who have proved to be very, very popular. There's always something new at our zoo. It's Nebraska's number one tourist attraction, and they had a record attendance in 2012, thus being ranked by TripAdvisor as the number one zoo in the country. Which, of course, we've always thought it was the number one zoo in the country. The zoo is for all seasons. Just because it's winter doesn't mean that you shouldn't be out at the zoo. There's always something to see. There's places to go indoors, wonderful walking areas in the wintertime. My favorite recollection was one winter when my husband and I were supposed to vacation with my parents, who would go to Arizona for a few months every year. Well, we couldn't go, and we really bummed about that. So we missed that environment so much, we decided we would go spend a day at the Desert Dome. You know, it wasn't the same, but it did help the pain. I am pleased to introduce today's special guest presenter, Dennis Pate, since 2009, Executive Director and CEO of Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo and Aquarium. As a matter of fact, the aquarium, when it was completed in April last year, that was Dennis's first project when he came on board. So he's been busy ever since he got to Omaha. He is responsible for all facets of park management, including animal programs, research, education, facilities, marketing, and government relations. Prior to coming to Omaha, Dennis was executive director of the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, senior VP of the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, and general curator of the Oregon Zoo. He serves on the board of directors of the Association of Zoos and Aquarium. Dennis holds a B.S. degree from the University of Illinois and an M.S. from Northeastern Illinois University. Now, following his presentation, Dennis will take your questions. You'll find paper and pencil on your table. Please write down your questions. They'll be brought to me at the podium. And I've got one in the basket already, and that's it. I want to know from him what happens at the zoo when it says, storm warning, go to the grocery store, watch out, it's coming to hit Omaha. But we'll have him answer that later. Please welcome Dennis Pate.
And thank you for that fine introduction. I'm happy to be here to tell you about what's going on. It's been almost 4 years since I arrived in Omaha, in March 9th of 2009, to be exact. And what a whirlwind it's been for me. I think the nicest part about coming here is standing on the shoulders of my predecessor, Lee Simmons, who really is the guy that put the zoo on the map, made its mark, made it really stand out with the Desert Dome, the jungle, the aquarium, and these exhibits that really are unmatched anywhere else in the country. He's the visionary behind that. My job now is to take it the next step farther than that. A little bit of background. The zoo has been there since 1894 in what was Riverview Park. By 1898, just 4 years later, there were 120 animals in the park, including bison that were on loan from Wild Bill Cody, who held them at the zoo here way back in 1898. So kind of an interesting start to, in many parks in the United States, eventually added animals to them, and that's the genesis of many zoos in parks. It started out to just be sort of menageries in the park. There was no perimeter fence. Pretty basic kind of caging for them, and they were curiosities in the park. Today, the collection's grown quite a bit. We have over 600 species now and over 6,000 specimens, and that's if you don't count any of the insects or fish. If you add those in, We've got 1,400 species and over 80,000 specimens. So it really truly is a little city full of aliens that live at the zoo. Popularity of zoos, pretty popular. There are 221 accredited zoos and aquariums in the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Bermuda. Of those, I should say that more people go to accredited zoos, to those 221 zoos, than all of the combined attendance at the National Hockey League, the NBA, the NFL, and Major League Baseball. If you added all their combined attendance up, it would not match those 222 zoos in the United States, Canada, and Mexico that are accredited. So we're big deals in terms of family recreation in the United States, with over 175 million guests. We do our part here as well. Joan mentioned last year we set a new attendance record. It was very gratifying to see that we matched the old attendance record in mid-October. And so everything after that was just gravy on top of that. And by the end of the year, we had 1,719,225 people that came to the zoo. Very much a record year. The previous record was 1 million, about 600. Interestingly enough, that record was set in 1995 when the then brand new aquarium opened. So it's sort of a testament to the popularity of that aquarium. And it's very interesting, of course, because here you can see 12 species of sharks and rays and pompano and triggerfish and some other things in the middle of America's heartland. And people here get a better view and a better idea about what's in the ocean than many other places in the country, and it's right here in Nebraska. So a very popular place. We already, just starting in 2013, we broke the record for attendance in January. Now, weather had a lot to do with all of this last year. We recognize it, too. But don't forget, the weather in the heat of the summer was terrible. It was in that triple digit for a long time, and we didn't make even our budget projection for the month of July, which is normally our busiest month of the year. So in spite of that, we still broke all attendance records. As I said, I came in March of 2009, and just to give you a feel for what we've gotten done since then, we finished Expedition Madagascar, which was underway when I started. That was part of Doc's vision. That was about a third complete. We opened Skyfari. The Education Conference Center was built under the aquarium. We renovated the grill, the aquarium itself. We built a new outdoor grill called the Omaha Steaks Grill. At the aquarium, we added 10 new exhibits in addition to all new ceilings, walls, carpeting, graphics, digital graphics. Quite an enhancement. We doubled the amount of outdoor seating and replaced it all for people that were staying for the full day and wanted to enjoy something to eat. And just last year, we've completely replaced our entry. So we've added new restrooms, ticketing, guest services, safety and security, and first aid station right at the entrance to the zoo. And in another month or so, we will have completed the other side of that entry, which has gift shop and stroller rental, completed indoor, inside the zoo, and outside the zoo plazas, added three bus drop-off areas and passenger drop-off areas that don't require you to cross the street, added a new S-curve-shaped entry drive, and we will have added, with the demolition of Rosenblatt Stadium, which is now complete, we'll have added 1,035 more parking spaces, which were sorely needed at the zoo. That brings our total parking to over 3,000 spaces. I don't know if many of you were able to come on a busy day, but what was typical were backlogs at the exit ramp, so that cars were backed up all the way up into I-80, which was kind of dangerous to begin with. The lot was often jammed, and we had to move people into some lots that we had acquired over the years, that Doc had acquired over the years, over in the neighborhood, just grassy lots, and you had to walk through there. It was compounded even more when Rosenblatt Stadium was there, because the only part of the parking that we had control over was the parking immediately adjacent to the dome. All the rest of the parking around the stadium goers had first preference on that. So on busy weekends, Memorial Day, 4th of July, we didn't have access to that parking until after the game was over, which was, for the most part, too late for us. So what happened is the interest in the College World Series grew, the interest in the Royals grew, and all along the way, the zoo had tremendous growth spurts, and we simply didn't have enough parking to resolve it all. And so coming June, before College World Series, we will have the other 1,035 spaces available and open and ready to go. Now, that's presented some other problems for us, because now with so many spaces and so many parking lots, we're going to be labeling all the rows in the parking lots and actually labeling the parking lots to make it easier for people to find their way back to the cars. So that's happening as well. The gift shop is going to be a 5,500-square-foot gift shop. And why the priority on gift shops is because we want to keep our admission rates as low as we can while still funding repairs and salaries and other things at the zoo, animal care, without always having to go to the admission gate. So we want to invite the widest range of people to be able to come to the zoo and generate revenue in other ways, whether it's gift shop or facility rentals, restaurant offerings, that sort of thing, so that we can boost revenues that way in an elective kind of way and not always have to go to the gate. Right now, the gate, as a percentage of our operating budget, it only accounts for 26% of our operating budget comes through gate admissions. So it's not very much to make the place run, and we're at about a $29 million operating budget right now. Another 21% comes from membership, and we have 79,000 member households now. Another 24-25% come from food and gift, and the remainder comes from facility rentals and education classes, that sort of thing, that make up the balance to reach 100%. So it's a pretty diversified income stream to keep us going. One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about, the master plan, and Dawn is standing next to the master plan now. That got done in June of 2010, and it's that has been our reference point for development at the zoo. So we had this big master plan. It's probably $200 to $250 million worth of exhibits to go in. And so we sat down with the foundation and decided what we were going to do first out of that master plan, and really decided that what we really needed to get done, we knew we were going to be acquiring the stadium, was to solve the parking issue. That sort of led into we really need to fix how people enter the zoo, because we had just too many lines to get off the interstate, too many lines to find a parking place, too many lines to get in the zoo, and no special treatment or facilitated quick entry for all the members that come to the zoo. Remember, members account for almost 50% of everybody that comes to the zoo as a member at the Omaha Zoo. That formula doesn't happen anywhere else in the United States. We have a much higher proportion of members, yet they all had to wait in the same ticket lines. And so what we have now is we've separated ticketing from member entry, so that now you go in one line for ticketing and members can go right to the redemption gates, show their cards, and get right into the zoo. So we're finding quicker ways to get into the zoo. We know people only have maybe 4 or 5 hours, maybe 6, to come to the zoo. And we want them to spend it inside the zoo, not waiting to get in, not looking for a bathroom, not waiting to park. And so that's sort of the thought behind a lot of that. There's a lot more places to sit down for people organizing their visit. There's a new wayfinding system in the zoo. And even I, walking around the zoo, didn't realize, you know, I was walking around one day and looking at the elevator building that takes you down to gorillas and the cat complex. And maybe because I'd been there some time already, I never realized that we never marked what that building was. So people didn't know what that was, what those doors were. It never said. Now it does. And so we've now taken the opportunity to look at the zoo through someone's eyes who has never been there and help them find their way around the zoo in an easy-to-find way. So we've gotten that in place as well. Just to give you an example of the kind of things the master plan will do, we don't have elephants now, but our elephant enclosures were built in the 60s. We had one or two elephants. The outdoor area was okay. The indoor area was tight for an elephant to spend winter in. And so our new elephant area will be 8 times. The building will be 17 times larger in the building, recognizing that we want to house a social group of elephants and not just one or two. And the outdoor exhibit will be 8 times larger than what we had before. The tiger space and the master plan, for two tiger exhibits, it's the same size as the entire cat complex. Excuse me. So, and we've got the room to do it as well. And so you're going to see exhibits that were mid-century, a little after mid-century kind of style exhibits go away and be replaced by immersion-style exhibits where there's much more room for animals to roam. It'll allow animals that are more social to interact with one another, like elephants, and it'll provide much better viewing opportunities where there won't be bars in the way when you're looking at things. So a lot more room. What have we done in order to help mitigate those older exhibits like bears and cats or two that come to mind right away? We have hired someone full-time whose job is to make animals happier, and to teach the keepers how to train animals to facilitate veterinary care. So we've got a behavioral enrichment. So we do different things in the enclosures. We offer different kinds of food. We introduce different kinds of smells. We provide viewing opportunities they didn't have before. We replace scratching logs more often, all in order to address sort of the psychological needs of the animal, not just the physical needs. On the other side of the coin, for veterinary care, a vaccination used to require a veterinarian with either a blowgun or a dart pistol to go down to the cat building, and as you might guess, the cats have all learned to recognize the veterinarians and really hate them, really hate them. And it was no fun for the lions or tigers or leopards as well either, because they saw it coming, and the anxiousness and anticipation was terrible on them, very stressful. So we've gone from that just 4 or 5 years ago to a system now. We've trained the cats to present the hip so that the keepers can hand inject the cat under no stress at all with their complete cooperation. So that's how far we've come in enriching the lives of some of the animals. Our gorillas allow us to do heart echoes on them. We can check their teeth. We can have them do a full body exam. We can listen by stethoscope to their hearts. We can look in their ears, all with their full cooperation and without going in with them and with no anesthesia, just by having them, by directing them, all using positive reinforcement and reward. We do use a little negative reinforcement, and so if an animal is goofing around on us and not complying, the negative reinforcement is we simply walk away. And they're really left kind of like, all right, I'll be good if you just come back, kind of attitude. And so we've been able to train everything from stingrays to sharks to Indian rhinos, and we're trying to get our Indian rhinos trained so kids can go up and pet an endangered Indian rhino and get a big thrill out of doing that. Right now, it's made a little bit more difficult because we can't talk them out of the mud watering hole with a big enough treat, but we're working on it. So his job, Jay's job, is to really train all of our keepers to be able to employ this operant conditioning, this reward-based behavioral system, in order to get the animals to cooperate with veterinary care. We can take much better care of them. So a bite wound that maybe before would have required anesthesia, a dart pistol blowgun, now doesn't necessarily. If we can call the gorilla over, have him turn his back to us if that's where the wound is, and get a very close exam and see what that looks like. And if it's not too bad, we can let it go, give him an antibiotic injection, all with their full cooperation and not needing to dart them at all. So big change in all of that. Our giraffe is another good example. We have a nice group of giraffe. Occasionally, especially in northern climates when they're not walking around as much, their hooves can tend to get overgrown, especially on some of the older animals that don't move around as much. To dart a giraffe is very risky business. Sometimes you dart them, and in their excitement, and as they start to go down, will fall over backwards. So it's a very scary proposition, and even when they do go down easily, you have to be very careful with animals that regurgitate their food, ruminants, because if you don't keep them sternal, up on their stern with their head up, sometimes they'll aspirate that regurgitant into their lungs and you'll lose them from pneumonia. So it's a very risky business. Now what we've trained giraffe to do is step up on a little pedestal and using it first a file and then an electric hand grinder allow us to completely do that with their full cooperation. So that's how much better life can be for an animal if we just employ for some of these techniques were originally developed in the marine mammal industry with dolphin shows and whale shows, but now we know we can do it with fish and birds and all kinds of things. And so the list of the number of species we're doing and how many things we're asking them to do is just growing every day, to the point now where we're transitioning that to another facet of what we hope to do. And we've just hired someone whose long title is Interactive Programs Manager. And so what their job to do is to take those training principles and apply it to better public presentations for the animals. For instance, the Indian rhino that I talked about. Sure, getting close to them really facilitates veterinary care, but what if we got them so that they were relaxed around a kindergarten class and all the kindergartners got to go up and get that close to an Indian rhino, of which there's only 3,000 left alive in the world, get that close to an Indian rhino and really experience an animal that with that kind of close and do it completely safely. So we want to take that kind of principle and apply that to lots of other animals around the zoo so that when you go and hear a keeper talk, you know, and I challenged her. I said, what if you were in the dome and the jungle, I mean, and all the bats that are living in there, you were able to give, blow a whistle, and have all those bats fly at once to one end and perch on a wire screen mesh while you were talking about bats and the importance of bats as pollinators. Wouldn't that be incredible? That's doable. It's going to take a little while, but that kind of thing is doable. Wouldn't it be impressive if you were standing in front of the sable antelope yard and you called all the sable animal up right to the barrier and were able to talk about them and maybe even have them lift their head up or put their head down so you can admire their horns or turn around in a circle or have them jump over something? All of that's now doable using positive reinforcement and reward. It takes a very patient keeper, and you take those complex behaviors and you're breaking them down into 100 little behaviors, then you string them all together to be able to do that. So we went from just chronologically, before we had a lot of drugs, lassoing a lion and pulling it up to bars to trim an ingrown toenail to darting a lion, which didn't make them happy. And then we went through a phase where we had, you know, like a cattle chute where you bring a cattle in a confined space to be able to do a dip or check it or tattoo it or whatever you're going to do, brand it. So we have squeeze cages for animals, too, to be able to get veterinarians closer without anesthetizing them. And now those are sort of passe if the animal cooperates with us in his own care. So very different revolution in zookeeping for those sorts of things. This year we're not opening a new animal exhibit up. Well, we kind of are. It's an exhibit of extinct animals, and so we're opening up a new dinosaur exhibit. Now, these aren't just small-scale dinosaurs. These are life-sized dinosaurs, the largest of which is Tyrannosaurus rex that stands 18.5 feet tall and 46 feet long. These are animatronic dinosaurs. They breathe, they blink, they wag their tail. They vocalize, they do all those things, and two of them are controlled by buttons, so the kids going through will be able to control some of the motions of the dinosaurs as they go through. There's 15 different dinosaurs that are arriving next week, and we'll begin assembling those, and those are going to go in an area of the zoo we had not used before. It's the area just north of the Simmons Aviary, across the path. A lot of prairie dogs make a living up on that hill now, but past that hill, beyond the tracks, there's a beautiful little forested valley with some meadows, and we've carved out an accessible path that will go through there, and so you'll turn a corner and there'll be this kind of dinosaur, then another one along the way, kids love dinosaurs, and of course education-wise we'll be able to tell the story of extinction and how it happened then and what's happening now with extinction with a lot of species. One of the things I want to tell you about now is some things you may not know a little bit about. Do you all know we've had a kindergarten class at the zoo for 13 years? So we've partnered with Bancroft Elementary School 13 years ago when they were running out of space, and Doc rose his hand and said, you know what, we'd love to have a kindergarten at the zoo. We'll make room. That was 13 years ago. We still have that kindergarten class today, and it's gotten so popular to the point now where parents have transferred their children into OPS school system, in particular Bancroft, so they would be eligible to participate in the zoo kindergarten class. So it is OPS teachers, but their playground is the zoo. And so what a nice opportunity for us to get these little kids loving wildlife from that age going forward. And so we've put a playground in for them, by the way. But then we have a lot of indoor buildings. Dawn and I like to talk about we have 7 acres at 72 degrees all indoors. And so it's a wonderful area to explore for children as well. So that's something that we've had since 2001. When kids are learning about language, there's no greater facilitator than that than animals. If you think about it, every kid in America has a teddy bear in their crib after they're born, or a little stuffed animal. What a natural connection to the wild world. If we can just bridge that teddy bear stage to the zoo stage and wildlife and learning about wildlife and wildlife conservation, that's the connection we want to make from birth all the way up. Do you all know that we have a high school at the zoo? We have a full-time high school at the zoo. It currently has 97 students. It's juniors and seniors from two different school districts, Papillion La Vista High School, which were the founding district, and OPS. Now, we've had a zoo academy, which is sort of a part-time academy for career exploration and for teaching about advanced biology, but we've taken that full-time now, so we've got these students from those two districts who sort of learn the core curriculum. And what's different about the zoo high school is then they apply what they've learned to real-life situations out in the zoo. It could be in veterinary medicine and drug dosages for math. It could be in horticulture once they've learned about plant transpiration off leaves. It could be about physics and spend some time talking to diesel mechanics and how engines work. It could be about English and writing and spend time with Don and talk about press releases and marketing. So it's a little city in there, and these are kids who love to be able to make what they're reading about and learning about more real. They get to learn it in a real-life context of all the things that a zoo can be: marketing, diesel mechanics, horticulture, veterinary medicine, conservation genetics, all those diverse fields, accounting we've got at the zoo, and they take advantage of those things. And so what we do is they get paired up with staff. So that ratio of student to zoo staff is very critical, which is why we would probably, even if we grew that, we wouldn't grow it much past 120 students. So it's not just another high school in a different venue. It's a high school with a different kind of teaching methods behind it that have these real-world applications. The high schools themselves choose the students. So we stay out of that part of it. They choose the students based on their how well they're doing in towards of meeting graduation requirements as a sophomore, whether they're progressing fine, whether they would do well in a less formal situation. So they, whether their parents are okay with it, they can still participate in after-school facilities. If it's football or chess club, they just go back to their home school. And so they do all of that. Again, another program that we felt strongly about that we made room for. So what used to be rental facilities for us are now high school classrooms at the zoo. So that's really very different. There aren't any other zoos. There's a few other zoos that have high school courses, but none of them have that same take where they really learn to apply what they've learned in real-life situations at the zoo. So I run into them all the time as they're doing projects around the zoo in the middle of the winter. Going forward, one of the new things that we're really interested in is early education. We see that as the real growth area for us, and I'll go back to that teddy bear example. We really need to get a lot of these kids at a much younger age, even before kindergarten. And so we are at the point now where we are about to pilot that program. You're all familiar with the Garden of the Senses. There's a beautiful little Tudor building down there. Well, that building over time has housed everything from cassowaries to giraffe to elephants. And more recently, it's our winter bird holding area inside. So we're going to take that and transform that into a classroom for early education. And we're now partnering with University of Nebraska Omaha to develop that program. And what we want to do is think about it as a lab school. So we test out new teaching techniques and methods with these early education folks. It's now a pretty raw bird-holding building for the winter. And we would replace that with some pre-engineered sort of pole barns up in a corner of the zoo to house the birds so that we can make room for an activity like this right in the center of the zoo. So a kindergarten class, a high school, a coming preschool program. What else do we have that you may not know much about? You know, one of the things that makes our zoo stand out, and it really is one of the things that attracted me to this zoo, was the commitment to conservation at the zoo. And so Doc developed these Center for Conservation Research at the zoo, and it's two buildings that house six PhD scientists. At the end of last year, in terms of evaluating that program, I asked them several questions: how many papers or presentations they'd given, how many were peer-reviewed, that sort of thing. And they are doing the kind of work that would rival any university kind of department, graduate-level department. They've done over 60 papers and presentations just in the last year, and many of those are peer-reviewed scientific papers. They've pulled down almost $600,000 in grants from granting bodies to extend their work and help pay for it. So a very impressive resume for there. What do they do? We have reproductive sciences, conservation genetics, plant conservation, and comparative animal nutrition departments over there. In reproductive sciences, one of the things they've done is they have figured out a way. The problem was, we'd like to get more genetic material from hoof stock over from Africa to strengthen our gene pool in this country. But a lot of the regulations for importing hoof stock are very difficult because they're set up to protect the agriculture industry from disease. And so we thought, well, maybe we can bring in semen. But that's not regulated. And if what's worse than being regulated is not regulated and not wanting to regulate it so that they won't tell you you can't, but you can't really bring it in. It's very difficult to be in that sort of no man's land. And so what we quickly found is that we've developed this filtering device for semen that will strip any kind of virus off the semen and make it pure. What we've quickly found is that there are great human applications for this with people who might have HIV. So we've now partnered with a pharmaceutical company in Sweden who are doing clinical trials on this product in both in Africa and South America. And within a year or two, we have a patent on this project. We hope to be able to take it, that they will be able to take it worldwide. And so people are getting artificial inseminations. It's a way for them to be assured that the artificial insemination process, they're getting the cleanest in terms of cleanest from viruses semen that they can possibly get. And so there are worldwide applications for this sort of technology. And it all started with an interest in importing hoof stock from Africa. Now it may have worldwide implications, and now we have the Gates Foundation interested and the World Health Organization interested as well. So right here in Omaha, Nebraska. So that's the kinds of things we can do for that. Our plant conservation department, one of the neat things is that the plant conservation people are right down the hall from the reproductive scientists. So right now, our reproductive scientists are curating a biobank in South Africa that works to collect semen and ova and freeze it so that we can maintain that biobank for future research. But one of the other things, South Africa's got a very unique plant palette in that country that's found nowhere else in the world. Well, our plant conservationist, because she's down the hall, has gotten wrapped up in that project, and so they're going to extend that beyond animals into plant conservation, a seed bank as well, of very rare and unique plants from South Africa. And so that is happening, and that's just a down-the-hall kind of collaboration that worked out really well. In comparative animal nutrition, more practical kind of aspects. One of the things we found on vampire bats, for instance, is the way we were collecting blood from the name just jumped out of my head, the slaughterhouse. We go there and collect blood, but the way we were freezing it wasn't good for the bats, and we were having digestive problems with them. And so they found out that the bacteria were causing problems, and so now we store it differently than we used to store it. So the bats are healthier because of that research that was done on that. We're looking into lemur diets. We sponsored a PhD scientist in Madagascar. And some of the lemurs haven't done that well in zoos. Some have done okay, some haven't done that well. And what she was able to do is follow groups of lemurs around in the forest, using her binoculars, watch what they're eating, collect samples of those leaves, dry it, ship it to Omaha, Nebraska, and have us do an analysis on their diets based on what she's seen them eat. And what we found is that they have 2 to 4 times more fiber in their diet in the wild than we were providing them in captivity. So that's going to allow us the opportunity to modify our diets here for not only the lemurs held at our zoo, but lemurs all over the country, some very endangered ones, and be able to take better care of them and better sustain them in captivity and in the wild. So we're reformulating those diets. We're looking at pork-based diets instead of beef-based diets now as well, and that provides an opportunity to save some money, and provide some variety of the cats. I've talked about enrichment, so they get their diet gets changed up a little bit all the time, and so we're looking hard at that. And in that case, we're partnering with some of the feed companies in order to come up with new diets for some of our animals. Perhaps our biggest gains are made in the conservation genetics department. We have named over 21 new species of lemurs, heretofore not thought to be separate species in Madagascar. And in addition to that, we've named a couple of lizard species as well. That I can't tell you how remarkable that is. Nowadays, if you named one a year, that would be incredible news. We've named 21 out of that department through the genetics work we've been able to do. You know, and it's typical with a field biologist, Dr. Ed Lewis, got his PhD in DVM concurrently at the same time. He's a really smart guy. And he started with an interest in turtles, first in Madagascar, in the Galapagos Islands, and then in Madagascar. He soon realized when he was there with turtles that a lot of the lemurs are in real trouble because of deforestation. Well, he's seen that, but he's also seen the importance of schools and teaching kids about some of the animals that are unique, and so we started an education program over there. And the deforestation has led us to look carefully at the topography there, see what the people's needs are, and what we're doing now, we're in the midst of a gigantic reforestation effort, but just on the ridge tops of the mountains, parts that are sort of inaccessible, but that will connect some of the habitats of the different animals. On the lower slopes, we're planting trees that are important to the villagers that live there, nut trees, fruit trees, banana trees, that sort of thing. And so we're employing local people to help us reforest a lot of this, and we've gotten 40,000 new seedlings planted to date. So big gains in all of that. And one of the things we discovered is that seeds from trees that pass through a lemur's GI tract, the germination rate is significantly better than seeds that just fall on the ground. So we're collecting a lot of poop that has seeds in it, and we've tested a lot of this, but the germination rate's a lot better, and it just tells you how interconnected a lot of these habitats are and the work we needed to do for all of that. We've been part of two BBC films that will be airing, an IMAX film, and the release dates are this year sometime. I don't have those exact dates. We've worked out the genome of the aye-aye that tells us about the genetic diversity of those populations, and then assigns them value as conservation units. Are they significantly different from one another? Are they pretty much the same? In plant conservation, I mentioned that collaboration in South Africa and developing that project, biobank of threatened plants. We were the one agency in the United States that listened, that Bermuda approached and said, we've got a fern, Governor LaFan's fern, that's very important to our culture and our history, but there's only two specimens left, and that's it, and then there are no more. So we took those and using different propagation techniques have been able to produce thousands of them, repatriate them into botanic gardens, and the next step now is to try and better understand what habitats those ferns come from and try and repatriate them to the wild in Bermuda. It would be like for us losing our bald eagle. For them, it's the Governor LaFan's fern there. And so we've worked on that. We've also worked on a number of Malagasy orchids and a really beautiful orchid that occurs in the Midlands called the prairie fringed orchid that's very endangered. We're trying to learn more about that. I'm about done. One of the things I wanted to close with, though, is if the animal experiences weren't enough that I've described, if the world-class science wasn't enough that I've talked about, if our educational commitments weren't enough to hang your hat on, then think about the $100 million a year economic impact the zoo gives to Omaha and Nebraska. It's pretty outstanding. And for comparison's sake, that's 2.5 times what the College World Series does. And it's slightly more, it's about even with what University of Nebraska Lincoln football program does, economic impact for the state. You take it for granted when it happens every day versus 6 or 7 games a year. But just to give you an impact, so across the board, economic impact, science, family entertainment and attraction, educational learning, you couldn't hardly pick a better organization than Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo. Thank you.
Stand up here.
Okay.
And ask
okay.
We do have a number of questions for you, Dennis, and if you out there in the audience haven't written one down, get it up here, because we just have a little under 20 minutes to answer questions. One of our guests wanted to know about our research in Madagascar, and I think you've pretty well addressed what's going on there.
Yep.
I did have a question that how is the funding set up for this kind of a project?
The funding is set up in multiple ways. I mentioned a lot of the grants that we get, and so we get a fair amount of grants to support that work. The zoo also supports it through its operating budget, and so both ways. And so it's a commitment the zoo makes, and in order to extend what we do, we ask that our scientists go out and find money to extend that as well.
Thank you. And by the way, I wanted to thank Dawn Rehm for helping with the demonstration here today. She is the communications and marketing director for the zoo. Another question, is your zoo especially important for any endangered species?
Probably not anyone in particular, but an awful lot of them. The zoos cooperate with one another in things called species survival programs that look at the genetics and demographics of zoo-based populations and try and figure out sort of as a computer dating service who are the best matches in order to keep a very healthy population. Most of those are with endangered species. We're working on some right now in particular, the okapi being one. I don't know if you know them. To the guests, you know, maybe they don't fully appreciate them, but to zoo folks, they're a real rarity from Central Africa. They weren't discovered until the early 1900s. They're a relative of giraffe. We've had three animals, one older male who's living out his life here, two other animals that are here. We've taken some time to understand their estrus cycle, and we've been pairing them appropriately. We have to do it with a lot of caution because males can become too aggressive with first-time females, and which frightens them, and then they're reluctant to stand for breeding. So we've had to be there through all of that, and if he starts getting a little aggressive, we pull him back. And we've gotten to the point now, we've learned enough about their estrus cycles that we only pair them when she's receptive and in heat, because we can project when that's going to be now. So lots of species, gorillas, penguins, there's probably three dozen species that we're working on.
What do you envision for the Rosenblatt property besides parking? I know there's going to be a special exhibit there commemorating Rosenblatt Stadium. And what's the status of that?
One of the parts that we wanted to do, Rosenblatt Stadium was so important to a lot of people, especially in South Omaha. The history of it, the College World Series, what it's meant to the neighborhood, that we've decided to go ahead and build a Little League scale infield with the same home plate and the same foul post boundaries. And so we've saved the left field pole and the right field pole. We know exactly where home plate's going to be. We saved about 100 seats from Rosenblatt Stadium that will be in the sort of Little League scale outfield. They'll be able to run bases. There's two little dugouts. It'll be surrounded by picnic tables. And in general, it'll be a little oasis in the parking lot. The footings are in for that. We expect that to be done sometime in June. This miniature Rosenblatt, we've saved that big arch sign that'll be there. And so everybody in the neighborhood and that visits will always know that baseball and the zoo were tied together by that common site. The other thing, it is going to be a lot of parking because that's what we've needed, but in general, that inside-outside plaza I mentioned has pushed across into 10th Street. You'll eventually see children's areas push the border on 10th Street and push that out of the way. It turns out we've owned 10th Street all along and never really knew it, but we were happy to let the city plow it for us for years. But and so you're going to see kind of the western border of the zoo just sort of push into that former Rosenblatt site and take advantage of that.
We have two questions about, are we still trying to get a panda, and how much would it cost if we did?
This wouldn't be a talk without a panda question. I can. The answer to that is a couple of different answers. Number one, my predecessor, Lee Simmons, who is as determined as anyone you'll ever meet when he wants something, witness the dome, and Walter Scott, who's got the resources to back up that determination, tried very, very hard to bring pandas to Omaha, and it just didn't work. It didn't work financially. It's very expensive. It's probably a $10 million cost just for the loan, and you can add in another $10 million just for the exhibit, and then you can add in roughly half a million to $1 million a year in operating costs for that. In short, For us to do pandas, it would have obliterated what we're trying to do in the entire rest of the master plan to try and get all that done in time and energy. They're being done right now in National Zoo, San Diego, and Atlanta. It almost drove the Atlanta Zoo bankrupt. San Diego makes it because they're in a tourist economy, and National Zoo did it because they're supported by federal dollars. We get less than 5% of our operating budgets from tax money. National Zoo probably gets 80% from tax money. It's a big difference.
I love this question. How on earth do you train a tiger to let you give it a shot?
A lot of moms with little kids are asking us that question, too. All I can tell you is it's one little baby step at a time. For instance, if I were to hold up a little ball on the end of a stick and I would say, touch, of course the tiger would know what on earth you were asking it, but it might, out of curiosity, lean forward and start to sniff it. At that moment, you would click your clicker and give it a reward. It wouldn't necessarily know what the reward was for, but if you do that enough times, it learns that if it touches the ball with its snout, it will get a reward. You can then start moving the ball to different places to move the tiger and reward it. Then you can start, once it understands the concept of if I touch the ball, I get a reward, you can start to do that with its hip and get it to touch its hip to the ball. And once you do that, then you can start to show a syringe and just touch them with a syringe with no needle on it so they don't get a big deal. And you touch it a little harder every day. Then you put a blunt needle on it and you poke them a little bit, but it doesn't break their skin. Then they're used to that. And then you get a sharp needle, a very, very, very fine sharp needle, and you inject. You just stick the needle in and take it out. And they get used to that. They don't necessarily like it always, but, you know, the little piece of meat's well worth it. And then you might use that same needle with a little bit of sterile saline solution that you inject into the tiger. And then you're almost there, and then you've, the only thing left is a vaccination. And almost all the animals that we've done that with voluntarily, they don't have to do it if they don't want to at all. They voluntarily allow us to do that. It's pretty amazing when you see it. But it's a lot of little steps and a lot of time and patience. You see the end result. We're just changing the cat building to allow a lot of that training to be done on public view. So we've had glass windows on the front of those indoor exhibits for a long time that we've had in place for years to put new logs in there for scratching posts. Well, now we've been able to open those and put wire on the inside so we can call the cats up to the front. Now, the first time we did that just last week, they looked at us like we were crazy and are we going to let them out? And they didn't come up. But little by little, in a process that I've just described, they will come up to the front, and we're excited about getting those five lion cubs that some of the biggest ones almost reaching 20 pounds now, but they're taking turns chasing and killing mom's tail right now. So they're a lot of fun to watch, and the ability to be able to call them up and have them be right there literally 4 feet away from you will be electric, I think.
Along with that, Dennis, the World Herald had a story, I think a week or so ago, about zoos using dogs to calm big cats. Do you see any need for that here?
It's not just any big cats. Most of the big cats, it would calm them because they would kill them and they would be full. But the only big cats you use that with are cheetahs. You can do it with cheetahs, especially cheetahs that you're using in interactive programs, and some people do. Ours have a little higher breeding priority, so we're not doing that. But you can raise a particular breed called an Anatoly Shepherd with them and to be their sort of a companion animal for them, and they will tolerate that, and they get along just fine.
How does an Indian rhino differ from an African rhino?
They're among the biggest. If you've seen the picture of the rhino that looks like he's got armor plating on his side, that's an Indian rhino. The white rhinos and black rhinos of Africa are smooth skinned. The blacks are fairly significantly smaller. Their whites are about the same size as the Indians. The whites have a much bigger head than an Indian rhino does. Whites have two horns. Indians have one horn. And white rhinos, especially males, have a long extended incisor that they use in the wild to chase away and do battle with other males who are trying to compete with them for access to females for breeding. The other rhinos don't have such a tooth.
With all the business going on, new construction and everything, a question about will the zoo be able to maintain its relaxing atmosphere while modernizing?
Well, I think so. I talked about doubling the outdoor seating. We've taken note of the hills. We have made sure, and I shouldn't tell you this, but the last tram ride of the day is free to help people get back up the hill so that if they take the time to explore the zoo and it's the end of the day, we give them a free ride back. So we're still trying to make it comfortable. We've got a lot of indoor buildings that are at room temperature, so even in the heat of the summer, it's a very comfortable place to be. We've added the outside grill, and you're going to see a lot more landscaping replace mowed lawns. And so it has a very unique kind of exotic feel while you're in there, I think.
I notice particularly the wonderful sculpture that is incorporated into the zoo layout. It's wonderful, and the landscaping in general. So it's a delight to visit for many, many reasons. I have a couple of questions here about weather. How are animals protected in severe weather? Tornadoes, hails, flooding, blizzards. And then not only animals, but what about us if we're visiting at that time?
I'll talk about the animals first. If there's anything I'm prepared for, it's high winds. Having come from Florida and lived through those periods in 05 and 06 when there was hurricane after hurricane after hurricane that was hitting that state, and I can tell you at any one point they were all projected to hit Jacksonville, Florida. The trouble for us in Florida was not so much the wind damage but the fear of flooding because we were right on a tributary of the St. Johns River. High winds and high tide don't go well together, and you're not that high above sea level. And we did have some flooding occasionally, but bear in mind, all those big animal exhibits are made to be hosed out. So they're flooded in some ways or wet, made wet every day. The bigger concerns really are the people buildings. We don't have a flooding concern here. It would be more of a tornado concern. We get advance warning from the Weather Service and would be able to warn people to be able to leave the zoo and go home as best we can. We do have places, basements in a lot of the buildings that we can bring people into, which is what we would do. First chance, though, would be to get people home as quickly as possible.
We have 5 minutes left and three questions. Will there be an exhibit of bones of extinct animals found in Nebraska and their history, for instance, Ash Falls?
Well, I'm not sure who asked that question, but we just installed that last summer, so you're a little behind. We have exact replicas of some of the Ash Falls fossil beds down at the Red Barn Park to go with some of the dinosaurs that once lived in the Midwest that lived there 5 million years ago. And so we've actually worked with the University of Nebraska Museums. They've made exact replicas of that. And instead of soil, we use little tiny rubber particles, and we use paintbrushes for the kids to brush all that away and discover the bones. There'll be a similar one done at the Dinosaurs Alive that opens this summer. There'll be another dig site for kids there, too.
The IMAX needs a price upgrade to show full-length movies. Is there any interest in doing this?
The short answer is no. And the reason is because IMAX has been losing money for years. The operating costs with that are probably $800,000 a year. And so we took a hard look at that, and we decided to make it part of a member benefit so that members now get free access to all the movies there. What we found is that people, through some of the work that Dawn's done, people come to the zoo to see the animals, and the IMAX is a decision made after they get there. If it's a two-hour movie, then that flies in the face of what I just said. They're coming to the zoo first to see a lot of the animal collection. We think of it now more as an education venture, another ride kind of thing. And the movies we get are either full-run movies or there are these shorts, these 40-minute shorts that are educational movies. We want to try and keep this mission positive if we can, and so we show more of the education movies that are specifically made for venues like ours that last 40 minutes. And we're able to rotate three movies a day in doing so.
And 1 minute to answer this. This is a good question. The London Zoo was trying but failed to raise $8 million about 10 years ago. I understand that more than $30 million has been raised for the Henry Dorley Zoo in the same period. How does this happen? This is what makes Omaha, Nebraska a great place to be.
The answer is it's part of the culture of people in the United States. They give a lot for their communities. That's something we may take for granted a little bit, but it doesn't happen all the time. In Germany, it comes out of tax dollars a lot of capital projects. Here in Omaha, it's all gifts. Since I've been here, $58 million has been raised on behalf of the zoo. That includes the acquisition of the stadium, a lot of the new exhibits that have gone in, the aquarium. And so in the last 4 years, it's been about that number. It's a huge number. It's from foundations. It's from individuals. It's from having a good year. And it's from private donors. In Omaha, in particular, is very generous.
Thank you so much. Thanks to Dennis Pate from Henry Doorly Zoo and Aquarium. Thank you so much. Also, thanks to our audience here at the Omaha Press Club and to our KIOS radio audience. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker has been Dennis Pate, Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of Omaha's Henry Doorly Zoo and Aquarium. The title of his presentation was, What's New at the Zoo? He talked about the zoo's master plan progress, including the former Rosenblatt Stadium site, future growth in exhibits, and significant animal acquisitions and births. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 28, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be this Friday, March 22nd at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a debate between five candidates for mayor of the city of Omaha in the upcoming April 2nd primary election, incumbent Mayor Jim Suttle, seeking his second term, and challengers, former Omaha City Council President Dan Welch, current City Councilwoman Jean Stothert, Omaha businessman Dave Nabody, and current member of the Nebraska Unicameral, Brad Ashford. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.